Okay. Wow. Well, whenever you get Karen DeBasian, you get graduate school in the faith. And I always think of there's the Psalms and there's Ecclesiastes, but then there's Job. And Job is a whistleblower on all standard theology that cannot be applied to every situation. It's true, but if you wrongly apply it, you cause a lot of pain to people. And interesting to me that Job's friends, at first when they just sat with him, they did what Kristen did with Karen and just laying there in empathy. But then they were uncomfortable and they had to just pull on the theology they knew was true. But they actually, if you think about it, right theology wrongly applied to someone in pain causes more pain than the devil. The devil took away the kids and everything else, but it also drove Job to what Karen's word entitlement. Nothing's sacred to us. I remember once seeing that beautiful movie about Abraham and he's sacrificing his son on the altar. And Isaac looks up at him and he says, "Is there nothing God can require, Lord?" And Abraham says, "Nothing." Yeah. Beautiful. Well, this hour, you're going to get some theory on the Psalms. And if you, it's at page 38 in your book. And we'll be going from that page. I can be linear sometimes. We're going to go from that page forward into the Psalm 142, which for both Karen and Elsie is their life poem that started them on this journey. So what I'm going to give you now is an introduction to the Psalter. And at the end of this time, you will know more than most pastors. And I'm going to give you some tools that you can outline the Psalms and know their context. So here we go. So the first thing you need to know is who's who in the Psalms. Okay? So this is not an ordinary prayer book of, you know, an any person praying about simple requests. The author of the Psalms is the king of Israel, who was called Messiah. And all Messiah means is anointed or smeared with oil. He's set apart. And the Psalms are a martial book of prayers to further God's kingdom in breadth among the nations and in depth among God's people. And for many, many years, everybody knew David wrote the Psalms until modern scholarship came along and then they questioned that. So I'm here to tell you, David wrote the Psalms. Not all of them. But he launched the ship. The whole first two book of Psalms are all authored by David. And anytime you see a by David, in Hebrew, when you get this little lamed, let David, it's always authorship in poetry. Why that's important is that the Psalms assume you know the backstory of Samuel. Because when you know stories, then images take on significance. And you may not be able to identify which part of the story is David's in a psalm. There's 14 of them that have superscripts that tell you the situation. And that gives you enough sense because they want a lot of them just so you can apply them in your own lives. But you need to know the backstory. And do you know we know more about David than we know about Jesus? There's more material about David for a reason. Because David's story shapes Christ's story. So it's very important. And the reason is, if these were just ordinary poems and prayers from so-and-so, what right do you have to apply them? How do you know they're applicable to you? You don't. How do you know they're promises you can hang on? You don't know. But if they're written by the Davidic king, those prayers shape history, and they become the prayers of Jesus. And there's some new dimensions in them with Jesus, but they are Jesus' prayers. I know what Jesus prayed. It's his book. And because you're in Christ, aha, now it's your book. These are your prayers. So that's very important to know. This is kingly theology behind the Psalter. Secondly, there's three main types of psalms that make up 100 of the psalms. And I'll give you a simple outline for them. It's very simple. And you can outline the psalms instantly once you have this truth. It says in Chronicles that David appointed some of the Levites as minister before the ark to petition, to thank, and to praise the Lord God of Israel. So there you have three different kinds of psalms, three different ways to pray because of three different situations. The first is the Hebrew word hizkir, comes from the Hebrew word zakar, which means to remember. And it's in a causative tense, which means to cause God to remember me in my need. So sometimes they call the petition psalms. I like lament the best because you're articulating pain. To cause God to remember me in my need. There are 53 lament psalms. When you go to church, how many psalms of lament do you sing? When you think of over one-third of Israel's hymnal was lament, why aren't pastors teaching the congregation how to lament? What is orthodox? Right praise. I'm not faithful to you as a pastor lest I teach you how to sing lament. But most of the time we come to church and we're just supposed to praise, and most of the time when I come to church, I'm warring inside. I have tension. And if you pour praise on top of me, you just shut me down without giving me an authentic voice. You know, especially when the kids are little and they always fight on the way to church. You're separating a war in the back seat and you arrive and you're flustered. And the first thing is hands held high, praise you, Jesus. And you're tempted to say other things. So authenticity in the Psalms is always beginning where you are. You don't fake it. Okay? That's lament. That's giving grief a voice. Thanksgiving Psalms. Within the lament psalm, David petitions and he makes a vow. And the vow in the petition is not, if you save me, God, I will be a missionary in Africa, I promise, or I'll never drink again. That's not what the vow is. The vow is, when God saved the king, he had a legal obligation to go back to the congregation and write a poem of thanks detailing how God saved him. Not to do that was sin. And so every prayer in the Psalter gets answered. And every lament psalm has thanksgiving in it, except one, Psalm 88. There he's so depressed, but at least he can pray, but he can't go to praise in confidence. Every other one has praise. So it dawned on me as a pastor that church isn't supposed to be just everybody on the stage giving you information, having you sing. I'm supposed to give you enough information to hear your voice, and so we can find out where God's alive. If God's answered your prayers, you know, your child, the prodigal, has come home, and we get to hear that, the congregation, we feel God's alive. God's alive over here. The marriage is put back together. Or God's alive here. They had cancer, but the person was faithful to death. And around the bed, it was holiness, and they want to share that with the congregation. And so this is the rhythm it's supposed to be in life. Praise psalms are then just raving about the character of God. They're at the end of the Psalter. That's where we're going. But there's a lot of mountain climbing and pain to get there. And some people, you know, they just want to get on the elevator and go praise and skip all the pain. Not me. I want to feel every crevasse when I'm doing rock climbing. So you could take a helicopter and go to the top of the Matterhorn, but you won't have any emotion when you get there. If you go up and your hands are bloody and you have taken small falls and your guide had to pull you up, and then you get to there's elation. And I want to feel every pain, and I want to be integrated when I praise, and so there's authenticity. So the praise psalms rave about God's character as creator and redeemer. Okay? And you know them. They're Psalm 47, Psalm 48. I always love it one time when we started to introduce more instruments at church, and when the drums came in, some of the elderly people went, "Oh my gosh, drums!" And so I don't have a lot of patience. In fact, the guy was outside going like this, and I said, "You know what?" Finally, I said, "Look, this stage is not big enough to get enough instruments on there to praise God. And if we don't get the instruments to praise God, the stones are going to cry out. So unplug your ears and get in here and lighten up." You know, or some, you know. And there's always this battle between the organ and the guitars, and yes. Now, where I do get upset are churches that play so loud, they give you earplugs. And it's a performance, it's not worship. And I've gone to those, and I'm thinking, the whole purpose of Israel, hear, O Israel, hear. And you're supposed to hear the content. It's not supposed to be a rock concert. So I draw the line there, just so you know, and I have no patience with that either. But you're taping me, so I better be careful. So how does this process work? So if you start reading Psalm 1 and you keep going in, you'll discover lament, 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 finally 7, now 8, then a little bit of praise, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, all lament. You go, whoa, why do we start with lament? Because that's where David's life is. So here's how the story works. David did not invent this process. God made him king. God gave him promises. You're to have a right-hand man. All people are to come to you. You're to render justice from your throne. I will be with you. Promises. But then there's life. First 10 years of David's life? Are you kidding me? Why are there two kings on the throne? Why does the other king have the CIA and the military? And all I've got is nothing. And I'm living in caves. And everybody abandons me. Now that creates a little bit of tension. That's what gives birth to disorientation. And when you get disoriented, your spiritual formulas don't work. If you listen to Karen, when that curtain came down, none of the old formulas worked anymore. The old ways of functioning weren't going on. She was cut loose. She feels displaced, dismayed, distraught, sometimes even betrayed. Betrayal and abandonment is the worst emotion you can feel, especially from fathers, but it is worse when mothers betray their children and abandon their children. So what do we do with tension at church? This is what we usually do. First, it's not happening. Denial, that's number one. And why are you denying it? Because the old orientation is sacred to you, and you don't want to say that it doesn't apply to every situation. That's why Job's counselors, when Job pushes back, they push harder and harder because they don't want to lose the old orientation. It's threatening them, but Job is a theological whistleblower. And he remains true to his oath. He knows he's not suffering because of sin, and he'll spank his life on it, and that drives the book. Denial. The second one, when it happens, you feel alone and isolated in your doubts. You think this should not be happening. I'm a Christian. You start to withdraw from your friends, from church, and you just begin to have doubts. Why is this happening to me? The third thing that happens is, come stand up, Elsie. Stand up. I'm using you. So Elsie comes to church, and she's had two marriages. Now she's on her third. That's not true. I'm just telling you. It's arbitrary. And she's in the midst of a divorce. And I say to her, Elsie, thank you for sharing, but God works all things together for good to those who love God. Bless you, my dear. And we just jump to praise and God's grace, and we never listen to her to embrace the pain. Why do we do that? We do that because her situation is a threat to mine, and I don't know what to do with her. Or like Karen's situation. I had her husband in my discipleship group. It was tough, because he'd dominate. And he only was at home when he's making dinner for us, but the dinner was so big, it took over everything, and it cut off all the intimate sharing we had. And to be honest with you, I had to shut down my group after all these years. I couldn't keep going with the guys because he was sucking the life out of it. And I love him. So that's what we do. Now, sometimes when you finally get to be 40 or 45, you're tired of all the pain. So you decide, I'm going to go to a counselor, and for $150 an hour, you vent all your disillusionment, and you're honest with a person in private, but never publicly in worship. I love counselors. I go to them. I have them in my discipleship group. Counseling is very significant, but there's a cheaper way to do this. Here's what David does. When he's disoriented, he writes a psalm of lament. And when you're writing lament, you have freedom to articulate every tension of the soul. If you cannot name it, you cannot control it. And when you're really in trauma, you're buried in pain, and it's like you come up for air, and there's a tidal wave, and you can't see, and you can't think. And when there's real pain and shame because of abuse or violence, and you think you just want to bury it and move on, you reign in life through speech. And the first step to healing is giving a name. If you can name something, you can control it. That's why the doctors name all the bones in our bodies. So David is naming it. Now, here's the good news. You ever troubled by the verse, pray without ceasing? And I'm thinking, it's like a shopping list. I got to pray for everything. Blah, 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 blah. And it's so, what I discovered in the Psalms of Lament, David only articulates one tension in lament. I go, hey, I got ADD, but I can do that. I did this for 2 years. Wrote my own Psalms through the Psalter between 1998 and 2000. Wrote them down. I did it. Only have to articulate one tension. And the reason why you can confront God boldly is that this is his program. He called you. He has a legal responsibility to save you. So even in Karen's life, he was not permitted to leave that curtain down forever. He had to show up. Now, these are the elements in a psalm of lament. These are like the scales of a piano. It's all written in your book. Save you making notes. You can just enjoy it. So it starts out with an address. You can always tell you an lament psalm when it's like, oh God. It starts off very direct. You'll notice in biblical prayers, there aren't these long, drawn-out theological introductions like, welcome the President of the United States, most holy person, blessed be he, you know, oh God, ground of all concern. It's just, hey, you! When you're in pain, you call on God directly with no fancy introductions. Secondly, there's the lament. That's the part of the poem where the poet details his pain. And he's honest. Now, don't dismiss this thinking, well, God knows my pain. Why do I have to say it? You have to say it. For God to come into that place in your life, you have to tell him verbally. And it's most healthy in worship with others. Then there's the plea, the petition, where they makes the requests. The requests are never long. Usually the prayers are very short. But there's a motive to go with it, and you have to have confidence that you have a motive that moves God, and usually it's his loyal love, his covenantal love. The Hebrew word is hesed. It takes 17 English words to give the full range of what hesed means. So when I married my wife, I made a covenant, and now my love is not based on my feelings, it's based because I made a commitment to her, and I'm legally obligated to show kindness, to show care, to come into her life when she can't help herself. I'm easily moved to come to her aid. And that's the basis of the Psalms for Hesed. That's the rope that never breaks, loyal love. And then there's the vow. So you know what the vow means. I promise to write a poem and come to church on Sunday and interrupt the pastor and tell him I have something to say. I do this all the time at church. You see how much more effective it is to have the sharing of stories along with my messages? How boring it'd be if you just had me? How much it adds to hear real life? That's the way it's supposed to be, all the time. I get upset our church services are too short, and I get in trouble always being too long because I want life. And I refuse, you know, we get 35 minutes to preach, but when you put a story in there, you know, you go over. But what do people remember? Yeah. Now, here's the biggest thing about poetry. Here's the surprise. Often you get this huge, abrupt change emotionally with this like, but you, O Lord. And this is the lodestone of theology in the Psalms. This is when, as David articulates his lament, in the process of articulating that in worship, in the presence of others, he gets an insight. It's not a big insight, you know, like a leap of an L. It's these insight that transforms him. It takes truth from the head to the heart. And he would not have gotten that insight if he had not been honest and vulnerable. So without honesty and without vulnerability, there's no insight. You just keep praying the same thing, the parking spaces, the healthy kids, the school, the husband. You have to articulate the lament to get the insight. That's how we grow. So you need to know about this poetry. This is not shopping lists of giving God a list of things to do. It's you connecting with God where you are on the mountain and saying enough to get you up to the next level. So there's a dynamic movement that happens in the poems. Through every poetic line, you're going to make emotional progress. And then there's the assurance of being heard. Okay? So, very simple. This is kind of... And then when you're heard, it is awesome. It isn't just survival. It's God does a new thing, and you don't even have words for the way he saves you. And as Karen said, it was like what he did was bigger than anything she ever asked. But it was a bloody road to get there, right? Surprising awe. So this is, I turned it off. How did I do that? Okay, shh. This is the life of faith. So this is not something you do once. This growth is something that happens till you die. Because I guarantee you, as your bodies wear out, I'm 60, how old am I? 66, I'm two-thirds of an antichrist. You know, I want to go on a hike today, but my knee hurts, you know, and it's like I can't do stuff I used to do. And so, and then someday, my children are going to do for me what I did for them when they were babies. They're going to help me go to the bathroom, you know, they're going to wash me, they're going to put me to bed, and that's going to be hard to let go and to trust them for that. So the life of faith goes between these extremes, between lament and praise. So I kind of like it like this pendulum, boom, confidence, faith. And if you look at that carefully, that almost looks like a ram's horn, a shofar, woo, where you blow in desperation in one end and out comes confidence out of the other. That's our life of faith. So this is kind of the formula of your spiritual journey. And what prompts us to pray is normally crisis. And then we lament, we petition, vow, and then what? The insight. The insight comes before anything changes. And then Yeshua, deliverance. So you know the word Yeshua, Joshua, Jesus? It means, it has two ideas. It's a military term of rescuing you against great danger, number one. It's also a legal term. God does it because it's right. God has a legal obligation to save you. You have a legal obligation to cry out. For David not to cry out when he's in pain is idolatry. And that keeps the relationship going. And so this is the journey we have on the mountain. So, do you have a voice? So this is what I tell everybody to do. Buy a journal. The best ones are called paper blanks because they open and they're stitched and they're beautiful. And put your name in there, begun January 2018. I got the date wrong. Then look at the psalm, allow David to be your voice, and then just add a line of your own. Very simple. Dear Lord, would it spoil some vast eternal plan if I had a small fortune of it? And then you ask God for a stage to share your voice, or you start a group of women with the purpose of sharing your voices. Can't be too large. 6 is a good number. It's hard to be intimate with a lot. And you share. And then there's praise. You have a voice. There's nothing like having your own voice. As I said, when I grew up, I was so shy. I'd go talk to the teacher and I'd cry. My dad never spoke, so it did not help to converse. And then my mother was very strong. And so I remember telling my dad stuff. It was just... So when I went to college, I had a full scholarship to USC in gymnastics. But then my sister says, why don't you look at Stanford to see if you can get in? So I went up. They had no money for gymnastics, but I just sensed God leading me to Stanford. And my mother was ticked because my dad was going to have to pay for this. Back then it was $600 a quarter, but anyway. So she's doing the dishes. And she says, Brian, have you decided where to go to school? I go, yeah. Where are you going to go? Stanford. Well, you better tell your father because he's got to pay for it. So I march into the living room. Dad is watching football. And you don't interrupt a football game. So I have to sit there until a commercial. So the conversation goes like this. Hey, Dad. Huh? I decided where to go to school. He doesn't say anything. I said, well, Dad, I've decided where to go to school. Oh, where do you want to go? I go, Stanford. He doesn't say anything. I says, well, don't you? He says, well, I don't care where you go. And it was like, my mother always made this huge thing so she could stay in control, but he didn't care. But that's how shy I was, you know, in having a voice. And especially when I face negative emotion, whoo, I run the other way, you know. I don't want to confront negative emotion. And I used to work on a staff, and one guy was very dominant, bigger than me, and I'm impulsive, and so I'm always spontaneously changing things. And he'd come in the office, and he'd look down at me and says, I thought we decided to do this. And I go, Dad, yes, anything you say, you know. But that's me. But now I feel like I have a voice. And what God did to give me a voice, you know how he does that? Rejection. The man I love the most, my father, when I came to Christ, the wall went up for 20 years. And I was his only son. I was the apple of his eye. Never did a thing wrong. But now, we couldn't even talk for 20 years. And so I'm the black sheep. And then I went to a church that had these wonderful pastors. And one of the men who started the church, he took me everywhere in my 20s around the world. I was the apple of his eye. He invested in me, and then my eschatology changed, and I didn't believe the way he believed, and he felt I should leave. And the wall went up. But I knew this is not about eschatology. This is about fathers and sons. And it's not right for me to argue with my father. So I just stayed silent. And it was very painful for him. And yet it ended up working out. But it was, they designed a Bible study, 12 other guys who believed like him, and I was supposed to come to the Bible study, and they were going to convince me. So now I'm like the lone sheep again. But I need that. I need to raise my hand and say, I disagree, and I'll take the results. And that's how I started to learn to have a voice. And this is just when I went to Romania, and there was revival happening in our church, and he felt I should leave the church. And by God's grace, it ended great. Okay, so we're going to do this psalm, and James has put it to music. So if you, yeah. So maybe if you give James a little applause, he'll play this for you.